My name is Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic. And by God's grace, in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since April the 11th of 1977. And for that, I am eternally grateful. I have a home group, and that's the West Connect Group in Jacksonville, Florida. We meet on Monday night at 7 o'clock, and if you're ever in Jacksonville, Florida, I invite you to our meeting. It's a very enthusiastic, big book studying group. And it's that we have a speaker once a month, and then we read a portion of the big book, and then we discuss it the rest of the month. I have a sponsor, my sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor, and they sponsor, and so on and so on. And I'm an active member in the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Billy. Thank you so much, Billy, for inviting me to come to your group. I'm very honored to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you so much for inviting me. Now, one of the things that I loved, I love that this, it says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. I think that when I finish tonight, I hope that I have done that. That I have given you how I have established my relationship with God. Because without God, without Alcoholics Anonymous, without sponsorship, I would not be sober today. And I'm very grateful for my sober, my sobriety, and I'm a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous and have been. And since I got out of treatment, 43 years ago. And, so I'm just going to do exactly what the big book tells me to do, and it tells me that I am to share in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like today. And I'm going to do that, and I'm going to tell you my story in a general way, but I think you'll get the gist of all of it in a general way. One of the things I'd like to start out by saying is if you have to have a bad childhood or a tragic childhood or any abuse in your childhood, then I shouldn't be here because that is not my story. My story is that I came from very loving parents. I'm an only child. My parents wanted to give to me and do for me everything they possibly could. However, whatever is inside of me that makes me mentally and bodily different from my fellows, I've always felt like something was wrong with me. I've always had this feeling that I just seemed to never be satisfied. I was just always restless, irritable, and discontent. And I just was not a happy kid. I was not that happy. One of the things that, in a couple of months, I'm going to be 80 years old. And when I was a little girl, mothers didn't work, but my mother worked. And I was embarrassed about that. I didn't want her to work. Cause I wanted to be like all the other little girls and come home, and my mother was there too. But that wasn't the case. My mother was a nurse, and so she worked. Now, my parents, she worked because my parents didn't make a lot of money. But what they wanted to do is they wanted to give me everything any little girl would want. Dancing lessons, gymnastic lessons, anything any little girl would want. And I just never had that feeling of being satisfied or grateful. And the other thing is my mother was a beautiful seamstress. And she made my dancing costumes. She made my evening gowns that I had in high school. And she made my clothes. And I was so ungrateful that I used to tell her, I don't want you to make my clothes. I want to buy my clothes like everybody else does. And I can see all that today. And there's another big book that says there's nothing worse than an ungrateful child. And that was me. My parents loved me and sacrificed for me. And it took me being sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous before I could really see that. I'm so grateful that I know it today, but I didn't know it for so many years. When I was 18 years, the other thing I want to be sure and talk about is I was raised Southern Baptist. Now I'm talking to people from Virginia, so you guys know what Southern Baptist is. And I was raised Southern Baptist, and I had an idea about God that was very distorted and a long way from how I feel about God today. But what happened was, is what I heard is that you're born a sinner, you're going to burn in hell, and if you sin, you're going to hell and you're going to burn there. And it just seemed like the God that these preachers were trying to tell me about was just a really angry God. And that he, and all that this God wanted to do was just burn me up. And I just had that feeling. So I feared God. And my mother even used to say, we're a God-fearing home. We live in a God-fearing home. Well, I tell you, I live in a God-loving home. I have an entirely different perception of who and what God is today than when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful that I have the relationship with God I have today. When I was 18 years old, I married an Air Force officer, and I just knew I'd found my knight in shining armor, and we were going to sail off into the sunset and live happily ever after. Now, I married a bomber pilot. And this man was going to be gone, and he was going to be gone for years at a time. And I was going to have to learn to be responsible for myself. And I really didn't want to do that. I really wanted him to take care of me. I did not want to have to be responsible for myself. The other thing is, I had no idea what I had signed up for. I had no idea what it meant, what it was like to be an Air Force officer's wife. I had no idea what that meant. To me, I just married a man I loved. I had no idea what was going on. It was really gorgeous. You know, when he got his wings and he was in the, you know, he was in his uniform and all, that was great. I mean, that was beautiful. I had no idea what that meant. And, we ended up, our first duty station was Sacramento, California. And I'm coming from Texas. I'm telling you, I'm a hick from Texas. And here I'm coming from Texas, and I'm going to get to go all the way to Sacramento, California. And it's just, I'm so excited. And we get there, and we do a lot of sightseeing. We're there about a couple of weeks, and I get this invitation in the mail. And it's from the base commander's wife, and it's got a big red mandatory stamped on it. And she is inviting me to a coffee. And I am expected to go to this coffee. And I go to this coffee. I have no idea what it's all about. All I know is that I'm sure that all the other wives there are, that they're educated and they're sophisticated. And I'm sure that's who they are. And that's not what I am. And she gets up behind the podium and she starts saying to us, begins to tell us what our responsibility is to enhance our husband's career. And that we are to attend all the functions that are all kinds of dining ins, if anything, and we're to be dressed appropriately. We're to give dinner parties, have dinner parties. These are the things that we're supposed to do. And I'm just sitting there thinking, oh my God, there's no way I can do this. And as soon as I left that coffee, I went straight to a bookstore and got a book on etiquette because I had no idea what she was talking about, where plates went, how you set a table. I mean, we just sat down and eat. That's what we did. And I had no idea what was ahead. And I also want to say I had not had a drink of alcohol. because also in that Baptist church, they said, thou shalt not drink. And I didn't. And so I went 2 weeks later from that, there was an Air Force officer's luncheon, and I was to attend this luncheon. And I went to the luncheon that day with those same feelings of being very, of those feelings of inadequacy. I had those feelings all the time, feeling I didn't really measure up. I wasn't educated. I just felt always those feelings. I hear that story so much in Alcoholics Anonymous. I almost think that's supposed to be a symptom, because that we just don't feel like we're enough. And that's how I felt. I just didn't feel that. I was just really felt out of place. I went to this luncheon, and when I got there, there was this long table, and it had glasses, little glasses all on this table, and it had a fountain with this liquid coming out of it. And I saw these ladies picking up a glass and putting it under that fountain. And I picked up a glass and I put it under that fountain. And I want you to know my first drink was really a woodsy drink, because what was in that fountain was sherry. And I put my glass under it and I got a glass of sherry. Now, that first drink I took is so implanted in my brain that I can still remember how it felt when I swallowed it. When I swallowed it, it was just, my throat was warm, and it was just warm going all the way down into my stomach, and it just seemed like everything relaxed. And it seemed like for the first time in 18 years, I could just take a breath. I felt like I had been holding my breath for 18 years. And it just, and I also was one of these really uptight people. And it just seemed like that alcohol just took that anxiousness that I had and just absolutely just smoothed me right out. And I put my glass back up under that fountain again. And I took another drink. Now, I didn't get falling down drunk that day. I don't know if I even got high that day. All I know is I had those two drinks. But what happened to me that day, I remember those two drinks, and I did not know that what happened to me that day would alter my life for the rest of my life. Because whatever is inside of me that makes me mentally and bodily different from my fellows and gives me an allergic reaction to alcohol, whatever that is, had just been ignited, and I would never be the same again. Now, I didn't become a falling down drunk like right away, and I just kind of eased into it, and it just seemed like it, you know, it was just drinking when we went out, and then it was drinking before dinner. And then it was drinking before you went out and before you go to dinner. And then it was drinking, drinking, drinking. And pretty soon it was round the clock drinking. And that's the way my disease progressed. I drank from the time I was 18 years old until I was 36. I drank 18 years. And I did have some drugs in that. I had gotten some tranquilizers there. Then they called them tranquilizers and barbiturates. I had a lot of sleeping problems. I had a lot of anxiety. I had a lot of depression. And I was given a lot of what I called back then tablets. And I would take those pills and drink on top of them. I took a lot of them, but it certainly was not my favorite thing. I loved alcohol, and I got that feeling. And what I did, it's just that feeling that they talk in the doctor's opinion, where you get that feeling. And I got it that day at that luncheon right away, that feeling of ease and comfort that comes at once from taking a few drinks. That feeling that comes at once. And that's what I always wanted. I wanted it right then. And that's what alcohol would do for me. Pretty soon my husband would start going, and he would be gone, and he was gone for years at a time. And I started having babies, and I had two sons. I had a son in 1960, and I had a son in 1962. And I took these two sons, and I drug them through to the disease of alcoholism. And what happened for me, I mean, the first few years I was, I was a good mother. I took really good care of my babies, and I did, I did whatever you were supposed to do. And I want, as I tell this story, I want you to know I loved my sons. I loved my sons. But what happened as my disease progressed, I became that person that they talk about in the big book that is a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And what would happen is I would start changing, and at first I would change, and I'd be so remorseful because I could tell my sons were afraid of me. They were just little boys. And as my disease progressed, the abuse progressed. And I got to where I was throwing my children into the wall. I was hitting them. I was screaming at them. And most of all, with all of that abuse, I was neglecting them. And by the time my sons were like 8 and 10 years old, somewhere in there, I was starting to pass out all the time. And that continued to progress. And what happened is I no longer could put my kids to bed, and I could no longer get them up in the morning. And I'm going to tell you a couple of stories. And two of the stories I get from my son. I have a son who's 36 years sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And last weekend, we had a wonderful weekend together. And we got to share the family afterwards. And when we get to do that, it's very painful to have those memories, but it's also very healing, because the more we do it, the more healing that takes place. But what happened is that he gets up this morning, and he says he's probably 10 years old. And he gets up this morning, and an alarm wakes him up. He has to get up and get himself ready for school. And he comes into the kitchen, and his mother, as he says, he assessed the situation. And what he saw was his mother laying in the kitchen with a drink spilled. He stepped over her, got his cereal, put it all together, stepped back over me, sat at the kitchen table, and ate his breakfast. And he says, that is an abnormal reaction to that scene. That you don't walk in and see that scene and have that reaction and have no feeling whatsoever for what's happening right there before you. And you see why that he didn't have an abnormal reaction to that is because he saw that scene time after time after time. The other is that I would I had a son who was a musician. And I had a son who was an athlete. And I'd say, I'll be at your concert. I'll be at your game. And what I would do, I'd always have a drink of alcohol. And I just never made it. So what happened is I'd come to and I'd see these little faces. And they'd say, Mom, you promised. And I'd start screaming at them. Can't you see I'm sick? What's the matter with you? Don't you think of anybody but yourself? And now I'm making my alcoholism my son's fault. And my oldest son was the one who took care of me. And you know, if you take any kind of tranquilizer or barbiturate and you drink on it, you don't breathe too good. And as many of the times I've come to with my oldest son screaming, Mom, wake up, are you dead? I needed to see that fear in his eyes. And you know, for the past 43 years, I haven't had to look at that kind of fear in anybody's eyes because of something I'm doing. And for that, I've been overpaid. in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm going to tell you what happened. That's the way it was. I don't have any DUIs. I didn't have any affairs. I saved all that for sobriety. I didn't do any of that. But what I did was I drug and abused two little children through the disease of alcoholism. And I had a car wreck in 1977. In January of 1977, I had a car wreck. And my husband said, Polly, there's a treatment center, and it's not far from our house, and I wish you would go. And I ended up going to that treatment center. Now, I want you to also know, I did not even know another alcoholic. I didn't know anybody else. There's nobody in the military we ever hung out with that is in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know if they even need, you know, if anybody needs to be. All I know is I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous or alcoholism. I had seen Days of Wine and Roses and I'll Cry Tomorrow, and that wasn't me. I mean, that's not who I was. And I'm not sure I even really knew what it was all about when I saw it. And so I went to this detox center, and they gave me this wonderful magic medicine. And when I got up the next day, I had just gone to sleep, and I probably slept for about 12 or 14 hours, maybe more. And I got up, and I went into the day room, and all the groups were over, and everybody was congregating, telling war stories. Now, I don't know if any of you guys have been to detox or to treatment, but, you know, that's what we do. We sit around and tell war stories. But I'm not telling any. I'm not telling any war stories. Because I'm not going to talk about how I neglected my kids. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not going to talk about how my husband is 100% disabled from the military. He is 36 years old with a congestive heart failure, where we know now is the result of Agent Orange. And he's got congestive heart failure. His heart is so enlarged that he can hardly walk across the floor and he can hardly take a breath. And he's about 80% bedridden. And I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about my dad in Abilene, Texas, which is 3 hours away from where I lived in Hearst, Texas, between Dallas and Fort Worth. I'm not talking about that I can't drive. I'm so drunk all the time that I can't get to Abilene to see my dad who is dying of colon cancer. I'm not talking about that stuff. I'm just being very quiet. And then I hear these people, and some of them are divorced, and some of them have been to jail, and some of them have been to prison, and they cuss like sailors. And I'm listening to all this, and I can tell you, then I didn't even say the F word. I'm really good at it today, but I didn't say it then. And I'm just looking around at these people, and I'm like, I'm not like these people. I am not like these people. And then I end up having a dinner house romance, you know, where sick falls in love with sick. And you're going to walk off into happy destiny. Well, we walked off in happy destiny for 58 days. And then I was 12-stepped out of a motel in Euless, Texas. And I was brought back into that detox center. And I had reached that place where I was so demoralized that I couldn't stand anything about me. How can anybody be as evil as me? Who does this? Who does these things to their kids? Who does these things to a sick husband? Who does these things to their parent? What is wrong with me? And I couldn't get it. I just couldn't get it. I just knew I was this evil person. And I had this idea of God. And I knew I was going to burn in hell because of all the sins I had committed. Who does this? And what I did is I just sat there for 7 days. Because that detox was 7 days. And I just knew that. I knew in my heart of hearts there was no way I could be sober. How do you live sober with that? How do you ever, ever get over that? How do you live with that? And so what happened when that 7 days was up, I got a bottle of scotch and I got a bottle of Valium, and I checked into a motel. Now, what I know today is I don't believe there's anybody on this Zoom meeting that doesn't have an angel in your life. Somebody who brought us to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We all have one. And I had such a woman in my life. And she said something came over her. And today I know what that something was. That was God working in my life through her. And she drove around until she found my car parked outside this motel. And she came, and I hadn't shut the door all the way, and she pushed it open. And she saw me laying there. And she called 911. And on April the 8th of 1977, I was pronounced dead on arrival in a hospital in Bedford, Texas. Now, needless to say, I'm here. I was resuscitated. But what happens is, in 1977, no different than 2020, if you try to take your own life, you're going to get the attention of the authorities. And what happened for me is I got the attention, and I was put on one of those 72-hour holds, and I was carted off to a psychiatric hospital, which was enough time for my husband to obtain a court order from a Fort Worth judge that I was a detriment to myself and others, and I was court committed to treatment. Now, one of the things that I see so clearly, and I recognize it not all the time, sometimes it's in hindsight, how God interferes in my life all the time without my permission. I didn't ask anybody to come looking for me in that motel. I didn't ask in both motels, and the motel where Frank had found me and brought me back into treatment. I did not ask anybody to come and help me when I was trying to take my life in that hotel. I didn't ask anybody to do that. And I certainly didn't want to go to treatment for 28 days. I definitely didn't want to do that. So what has happened is I can see how much God loves me and he interferes in my life. Thank God. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you that you interfere in my life and I don't ask for it. And I ended up staying in that treatment center. I had a really rough detox because they didn't give me any medication, and that really made me upset when I came out of the detox. But I'm really grateful because the director of that treatment program, when I went running to the nurse's station for my medication, my tablets, I called them tablets, my tablets, he said, "Not this time, Polly. You're about to find out how sick you really are." And I had a lot of DTs. I pulled my hair out. I clawed my face. I did all those things. And when I came out of that detox room, I said, "You don't treat an animal just like you treated me." And he looked at me with so much love. And he said, "Polly, if you make it, you'll love me. If you don't, it really doesn't matter." And in that treatment center, I began to be fed the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 and 12. They started taking us to meetings. They started bringing, meetings were brought into that treatment center. And we had people that would talk to us. We had people that would offer to sponsor. And I was told that I needed to get a sponsor. And what had happened is I had been so touched. The man that had, he had saved my life. And he was the director of that detox center. And this man had saved my life. And I, whatever it was, I just had this closeness to him. So I called him up and I asked him if he would be my sponsor. And he said yes. And that day that I asked him, he gave me my first sponsor direction. And he said, "You be at my house. You're in treatment right now. You just get treatment. But when you're done, the very day you get out of that treatment center, you're to be at my house." And when I got through with that treatment center, I was at his house. And Frank was amazing. Frank had been a Monsignor priest. He'd been a captain in the Navy, and he'd been an only child. And when I grew up in Texas, the Baptists hated the Catholics. Now, I can tell you, I don't think the Catholics saw one thing about the Baptists, but the Baptists hated the Catholics. And this man was a Catholic, and he had touched the depths of my soul. And I was having, and I just, you know, I was so terrified of God, and I was just telling him, there's no way God's ever going to forgive me. I have committed immortal sins, and the only thing that's going to happen to you is you're going to burn in hell. And Frank looked at me and he said, Polly, I want you to believe that I believe. You use my God. For right now, you use my God. And I'm here to tell you, I did not find my God that I have today in the Catholic Church. I found my God in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, I want you to use my God, because my God is loving, my God is forgiving, and my God wants you to be happy more than anything else. That's what he wants for you. And after he had told me, I also had marched in there and said I was on my sixth step. And he said, no, Polly. I said, I did my fifth step in treatment yesterday. And he said, no, you're not on your sixth step. You're on the first step. He said, that is treatment center. That's just treatment center stuff. Psychobabble. That was the word he used. Treatment center psychobabble. And he says, but we're going to do this program as it's written in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what we began to do. We began to read the book. And by about 3 weeks, I had done my fourth step by his direction and what he had told me to do exactly as it's laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was ready to do my fifth step. And I did my fifth step with him. And what he did when I finished, again, with so much love, he said something that I couldn't swallow. I knew to be the truth, but I never could say it. And that is he looked at me and he said, Polly, you are a child abuser, and you're going to go to your sons and you're going to make amends. How do you do that? And I didn't know how you did that. How would you do that? And he said, he started having me write out the amends, and he had me write out things that I had done and what I was, you know, what I was trying to repair. And he had me write that down, a little 3x5 cards. And he says, if you don't write it down, you may not be able to get it out. So I wrote it down, and then he had me write on another 3x5 card, and it said, I'm so sorry that happened to you, and I will spend the rest of my life being the very best mom I can be. And what happened was, is I did my amends with my boys. When I got through, I did just what the book said to do. It said to ask them if there's anything that I left out, is there anything that you need to say to me, and I'm here to tell you, they started firing at me. And I just stood there with my little card, and I just kept reading, I'm so sorry that happened to you, and I will spend the rest of my life being the very best mom I can be. Now, I made many amends since then to those boys. That was the best I could do with a couple of months of sobriety. That was the best I could do. But since then, there's been a lot of amends, and there's been a lot of action. And there's been a lot of talk about amends as we have gone on this journey. And it seemed like I got sober and my libido woke up. And it just seemed like I was having all these affairs and Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I'm bringing all kinds more shame on myself. So my next inventories are going to be a lot longer than my first one. I was bringing a lot of gossip and shame to myself. But I was friends with this man named Dave Pistol. and he was my friend. I wasn't having an affair with him. Now, he was sponsoring a lot of the men I was having an affair with, so he knew more about me than he needed to. But I was telling him, you know, we were friends, and I was sharing with him, and he was sharing with me. And when I was 3.5 years sober, and Dave was 4.5 years sober, he came to me, and he said, "Polly, I don't want to have an affair with you. I want to marry you. And I want you guys to know, God willing and the creek don't rise, on October the 27th, Dave and I'll be married 40 years. And I have been married to the man of my dreams." And as bad as it was, my husband ended up, my first husband, ended up meeting a lady in church, and they were married, and they got to have a life together for 17 years before he died. And it was so amazing for him, because I couldn't take care of him. I just, whatever it was, it was just, and I'm so grateful. So God totally took care of both of us in such a way. I mean, he didn't have to experience the shame I did, because he didn't do anything shameful that I had to. But Dave and I have had an amazing marriage. But you know, we've got to travel the world. We've gotten to be able to speak together. Dave put together a workshop called Traditions in Relationship, and we've been able to go all over and do that. And because one of the things that was so important to us is that I'm Dave's fourth wife, and he said, "I am determined that whatever we need to do, that this marriage is going to work. And the only way it's going to work is if we are absolutely planted in the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts." And we began to take the traditions and work them in our life. Because what we have been taught is that the traditions, the steps are to the individual, and the traditions are to the group. And Dave and I were a group, and we needed to work the traditions in our relationship. And we started doing that. And Dave and I have had, but life shows up, okay? Life's in session. Just because you're sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't mean that life is not going to show up. And life has shown up. 18 years ago, Dave's son Michael died. And he was 11 years sober, an active member in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a beautiful, beautiful man. And he died. So, and we had the grief of losing a child. And that happened. In 1993, Dave lost his job. Dave's a computer scientist. I mean, headhunters were calling all over the place for him to come work for them. And the bottom falls out of aerospace in Southern California, and Dave loses his job. Our whole block went up for sale. And what happened is, we just knew Dave would get another job. I mean, we just knew that. But Dave didn't work again in his field for 2 years. He ended up with 2 minimum wage jobs. And I was working, but I didn't make enough to float our boat. And what happened is we ended up having our house foreclosed on us, and we ended up filing bankruptcy. And we were 16 and 17 years sober, and we'd been traveling everywhere. And Frank Honeycutt, who was Dave's sponsor, and my sponsor now was a woman named Dottie Harris, and she was amazing. And Frank Honeycutt was the Frank who was my first sponsor. Because Frank had gotten sober at Long Beach Naval Hospital, and Frank was his sponsor. And then Dottie and Frank had gotten sober together. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. You can't make it up. And I'd heard her speak in Austin, Texas, when I was about a couple of years sober, maybe 3, I don't know. And I said, if I'm ever anywhere where this woman is, she touched my heart so much, I'm going to ask her to sponsor me. And sure enough, Dave gets transferred to Southern California. And as soon as we get there, I call central office, ask for a phone number. They told me where it was. She told me to meet me at Bellflower Big Book in Bellflower, California at 8:30, and we could meet. And then a few days later, we had coffee, and she was my sponsor for 33 years. And she was an amazing, amazing person. And Frank was an amazing person. And she knew him, of course. I mean, it's just, how do you do this? How do you can't make this stuff up? And so anyway, I'd get invited to speak somewhere, or Dave and I, and I'd say, oh my God, I just can't do it. You know, because what will people think when they find out we're filing bankruptcy? I mean, they'll wonder what step we're working. And Frank says, it's none of your business what people think. Your very life depends on what they think of you. And I just, you know, and Dottie, I'd watched her walk through so much adversity, and she had stayed sober. And she says, Polly, you always have to stand at the podium and tell the truth. That's what they were talking about here in this book. We tell the story. We tell it all. And I had to tell, she said, people need to hear that. They need to know that you can stay sober and go through bankruptcy and foreclosure, that you can stay sober no matter how much you're humiliated and embarrassed. You can stay sober. And I started to do that. What happened is, when I was 6 and a half years sober, so this was before that, my youngest son called me on the phone, and he said, Mom, I want what you have. And 6 and a half years before, he did not want what I had. I was supposed to speak at his school, and because I had gotten sober, and they wanted some sober people to come talk to the classes. And he said, don't you dare show up at my school. I'm so ashamed of you. And they had told me at that amends how ashamed they were, how much I had embarrassed them. And 6 and a half years later, my son's calling me. And today, James is 36 years sober. We've been walking this walk together. For 36 years. And I mean, it's just an amazing thing. And we get to talk together, and we get to share together, and we get to talk about how you heal this, and how the program heals families. We get to talk about that. And what happened is I started sponsoring a lot of women. I was just so blessed to have these women in my life, and I got to sponsor them, and our lives were just, it was just going, I mean, you get through this, you know, this hurdle, and then you have another hurdle. Well, I want to tell you what happened to me at 5 years of sobriety. 5 years of sobriety, because there may be some Al-Anons on this. At 5 years of sobriety, I got a phone call from my daughter-in-law that my oldest son had put a pair of scissors in his stomach. And my youngest son was down on Venice Beach running and drunk and drinking and drugging. And I was on my way to a meeting when I got that phone call. And I got into that meeting, and it was one of those meetings I can't stand, where it says, does anybody have a problem? And I raise my hand, and I tell them what's going on with my sons. This old guy in the back says, you just need to turn those boys over. And I flew up out of my chair, and I said, you want to tell me how to do that? And he didn't know either. But what happened was, again, God has interfered in my life so many times without my permission. This lady walked up to me, who was a double winner, and she said, Polly, I need to take you to an Al-Anon meeting. I'll pick you up tomorrow. And she picked me up, and she took me to this Al-Anon meeting. And all these women surrounded me, and they said, Polly, of course you feel the way you feel. You're a mom. But what we're going to do is we're going to show you how to love your sons without it killing you. So I just kind of want to bring you up to today. My life is totally different today. A lot of things have happened. Dave and I moved to Florida 10 years ago. And this is where we had decided we moved to Birch Bay from California, and that's way up by the Canadian border in Washington. And Dave loved it, and he ended up having open heart surgery, and he could no longer rock climb and mountain climb and do all the stuff that he always loved to do. So all the rain and everything kind of got to us, and we decided to move to Florida. And we had some friends here, so we moved to Florida in 2010. And it was an amazing move. We loved it. But in 2015, our life changed. And in 2015, Dave started getting sick. And he first had lung cancer, and then he had a couple of back surgeries because he could hardly walk because his back was so bad. And those surgeries didn't really work. Then he had bladder cancer, and he ended up having two surgeries of bladder cancer, and now he has Parkinson's. And so Dave's been very, very sick. But one of the things that I love is I truly, my first sponsor, Donna, used to talk about do-overs and repeat for correction, that we get to repeat for correction, and God gives us the opportunity to do do-overs. The first he did is he gave me 5 grandchildren. And I'm telling you, I was a roller coaster riding grandma, and I would keep these kids. My sons would go away for like weeks at a time, and I would keep my grandchildren. My sons would leave their children with me and go away for weeks. And what, they even went to Europe and left me with the children. I mean, could you believe that they would trust me to do that? And I got to do a do-over. Well, you see, I never could take care of my first husband. I never could care for him. My sons really were the ones who cared for him. But today I am Dave's 24/7 caregiver. And I get to take care of him. And I get to care for him. And not only that, it's a privilege and an honor. And, you know, I get to do that. I am married to the man of my dreams, and I get to care for him, and I'm so grateful. That is what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. It is totally, my son James said, when he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, he says, I know Alcoholics Anonymous works because my mother has been transformed. That's what it does. Alcoholics Anonymous transforms us. It gives us a set of tools, and we get into that toolkit, and we can work those steps. And those steps have one purpose, and that's to bring us to a power greater than ourselves that can solve our problems. It gives us a God of our understanding, and I have that God today. And I'm on several large prayer lists because of all of the unsettling that's in our country now. I know God works. God has given me a life beyond my greatest expectations. He has given me the opportunity to be able to be forgiven. My sons have forgiven me. I can't tell anybody enough. Work your steps and get your amends. My daddy died 1 year and a month. After I was sober, I'm so grateful I got to make direct amends to my dad. And I was able to care for my widowed mother for years to be the best daughter I could be. I got to do that. And I got to be there when she died and be able to be there with her. God gives us do-overs and lets us allow to be different people because He's entered our lives, and he has been there for us. I am so grateful for my sobriety, and I'm so grateful to be able to be sober, and I'm so grateful to be at your meeting, and I thank you so much for having me.